Hello, I'm your reader, Aaron, and it's time for our birthdays. Happy birthday to Alan Childs of Des Moines, William J. Coyle of Des Moines, Larry Fallon of Boone, Christine Hazlitt of Grinnell, Catherine Kirk of Iowa City, Barbara Osborne of Des Moines, Artis Sandsgaard of Humboldt, and Bob Alsup of Cedar Rapids. If today was your birthday and you didn't hear your name, give us a call so we can be sure to get you on our birthday list. Now, let's get back to the news with our first story from the USA Today. Election 2020 presidential debate. Trump-Biden brace for onstage brawl. Stakes high for tonight's debate, the first of three, by Courtney Submarinian, John Fright, and David Jackson, Washington. President Donald Trump and Democratic challenger Joe Biden will meet face-to-face for the first time in the 2020 campaign Tuesday in what analysts expect will be a bruising presidential debate hinged on personal attacks. The 90-minute contest in Cleveland, the first debate of the general election, will be stripped of typical debate standards. There will be no handshake because of coronavirus concerns and no opening statements, fitting for an unconventional race that has been eclipsed by the coronavirus pandemic, social upheaval, and a heated Supreme Court battle over the vacancy left by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death. A little over a month from Election Day, Trump will seek to close his nearly 7-point deficit in national polls, while Biden will present his case for why he's a better alternative. Strategists and historians say achieving these aims, they say, may mean that touchy subjects such as attacks on the candidate's children will be on display for a national audience in prime time. Quote, I think every aspect of this thing is going to be just a barroom brawl from the very beginning, end quote, said Terry Sullivan, a Republican strategist who managed Senator Marco Rubio's 2016 presidential run. Quote, that machismo is going to really come across when they're face to face, and Trump is going to try to do some things to needle him, end quote. Biden will be forced to balance standing up to Trump, no holds barred approach without losing his cool while also portraying himself as a steady hand alternative, said Nick Everhart, a Republican media consultant. Quote, he's running a campaign built on the idea that he's this competent, tempered, and even keeled leader who would handle the challenges of the moment more calmly, end quote, Everhart said. Quote, in being tough and fighting back, they don't want to undermine his macro message that he's more of a steady alternative compared to President Trump, end quote. Biden has insisted he can meet the challenge, telling supporters at a virtual fundraiser on September 10th that he knows, quote, how to handle bullies, end quote. Quote, I hope I don't get baited into getting into a brawl with this guy, Biden said. It's going to be hard because I predict he's going to be shouting, end quote, and trying to interrupt throughout the debates. Trump has leveled harsh criticism on his opponent, accusing Biden of taking performance-enhancing drugs, questioning his mental acuity, and repeatedly attacked his own son, Hunter Biden. The former vice president, for his part, delivered an impassionate speech calling Trump quote-unquote unfit for the office after a report from The Atlantic alleged the president disbarged members of the U.S. military who have been captured and killed, a claim Trump denies. Biden also declared Trump a threat to the safety of Americans for his handling of the coronavirus pandemic that has left more than 200,000 Americans dead, and he has accused him of fanning the flames of racially motivated violence. Biden may have more fodder after the New York Times published a story Sunday showing Trump paid $750 in personal income tax in 2016 and 2017 and paid none in other years because of tax write-offs and business losses. Though the race has tightened, Trump remains behind in several battleground states, according to recent polls. A Washington Post ABC News last week found Biden and his running mate, Senator Kamala Harris, led Trump and Vice President Mike Pence 53% to 43% among registered voters, virtually unmoved from over the summer. Quote, he needs to do something to shake up and move the narrative because right now the status quo isn't going to get him to a win, end quote, Everhart added. Tensions could build from the outset. There will be no handshake between Trump and Biden over COVID-19 concerns, according to Peter Iyer, senior advisor to the Commission on Presidential Debates. There will also be no opening statements from the candidates or the moderator, Chris Wallace, who will pose the first question to Trump. Neither the candidates nor Wallace will wear masks once they take the stage at the Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland Clinic. The Trump-Biden cage match is likely to be even more contentious than the president's first run against Hillary Clinton 4 years ago, in part because none of the contestants are women. Quote, Clinton had to worry about debating as a woman and her likability, whereas Biden doesn't, end quote, said Jennifer Mauricia, a Texas A&M University professor who teaches classes on presidential communication, argumentation, and debate and propaganda. In the meantime, she added, quote, Biden has shown that he's willing to be aggressive when he needs to, and I think we'll see him match Trump's aggressiveness, end quote. Trump, who like this year was trailing in the polls as the debate approached in 2016, was criticized for his aggressive attacks on Clinton and is likely to employ the same strategy this time around. Trump aides have said for months privately that they need to chip away at Biden's support to have a chance. Quote, Trump's style is to go in for the personal attack, end quote, said debate historian Alan Schroeder. Quote, he certainly did that with Hillary Clinton, and I expect he will do that with Biden as well, end quote. Trump's attacks on Biden have been so pervasive, they are central to his core message, cropping up both campaign and official White House events. He has used the term Sleepy Joe at least 72 times in September at rallies and official White House events, according to a USA Today analysis of transcripts. Few areas have been out of bounds for Trump, who has leveled baseless accusations in interviews that Biden is taking performance-enhancing drugs and repeatedly mocking the former vice president for wearing a mask, among other attacks. Trump has traditionally been far more likely to level ad hominem attacks while standing alone at a podium or during an interview than while sharing a stage with the subject of his barbs. But in his 2016 debates with Clinton, Trump described his Democratic opponent as angry and a liar, and he called her campaign crooked. Despite the vitriol, Clinton and Trump largely left their families out of the race. When asked to say something positive about each other during a debate on October 9, 2016, Clinton said she respected his children, whom she described as, quote, incredibly able and devoted, and I think that says a lot about Donald, end quote. This time, Trump has targeted his Democratic challenger's son, Hunter, who has become a sore spot for both the former vice president and the president. Hunter Biden's role on the board of a Ukrainian gas company, while his father led in an international anti-corruption push in Kyiv under the Obama administration, sparked a GOP Senate-led investigation that found no evidence of wrongdoing. Trump was impeached for pressing Ukraine's president to investigate the Bidens, but was acquitted by the Senate. Quote, where is Hunter, end quote, Trump asked supporters at a recent rally in Fayetteville, North Carolina, repeating a phrase that has become a battle cry on his campaign. Quote, I think it will be brought up in that debate, end quote. Sullivan noted that Trump has more to lose this time around. Quote, nobody thought he was going to win, and he didn't think he was going to win, end quote, he said. Quote, now it's ridiculously personal because he'll be embarrassed if he loses, so much more defensive than he was last time, end quote. But the president faces a historic challenge as well. Incumbent presidents seeking re-election tend to struggle in their first debate, analysis point out. President Barack Obama faltered in his first debate against challenger Mitt Romney in 2012, as did President George W. Bush against John Kerry in 2004. President George H.W. Bush struggled to gain his footing in his first debate in 1992, squeezed between challengers Bill Clinton and Ross Perot. The examples go back decades. Ronald Reagan doddered his way through a 1984 clash with Walter Mondale. 4 years before that, Jimmy Carter stumbled through his one and only debate with Reagan. Trump has not had to debate anyone during his presidency, Schroeder pointed out, while Biden sharpened his skills during the Democratic presidential primary race. Quote, 4 years as an incumbent means 4 years in which you've been deferred and people are telling you what you want to hear, end quote, said Schroeder, author of, quote, Presidential Debates, Risky Business on the Campaign Trail, end quote. Quote, on a debate stage, your opponent is going to do the opposite, end quote. The Trump campaign spent majority of the summer excoriating Biden as inherent and unable to string sentences together without a teleprompter. The campaign has accused the former vice president, who has campaigned largely virtually because of coronavirus concerns, of using the pandemic to get out of traditional campaigning and even the debates. Quote, there's this idea or thesis that Biden is going to slip up or isn't sharp enough to handle the moment, but I think if you look at it historically, he's performed pretty well in most debates, end quote, Everhart said, with the exception of the early Democratic primary debate in which a gaffe-prone Biden was dragged for dated cultural references and cutting himself off early. Quote, but the 10 candidate versus head-to-head debates are night and day, end quote, he said. In recent weeks, Trump and his campaign aides have insisted Biden is likely to do well in the first round, given his decades of experience in more recent matchups during the Democratic primary race. Quote, he's been doing it for 47 years. I've been doing it for 3.5 years, so he should be able to beat me. He's much more experienced, end quote, Trump told supporters at a rally in Ohio last week. There will be a small number of ticketed guests instead of a traditionally packed audience, according to the commission. The lack of crowd may undercut Trump, though it won't make him any less aggressive, said Mercecia, author of, quote, Demagogue for President, the Rhetorical Genius of Donald Trump, end quote. Trump, in particular, feeds off of audience reactions, Mercecia said. Quote, he's like a child who acts out in class. It works well when he is performing for his classmates, but it doesn't work so well in the principal's office, end quote. Robert Barnett, a veteran Washington attorney who has advised Democratic presidential candidates on debate preparation since 1976, argued that Trump and Biden are likely to approach Tuesday very differently, with Trump leaning heavily on his law and order message in his attempt to frame Democrats as quote-unquote socialists. Biden, on the other hand, will almost certainly focus on the pandemic, the economic turmoil it has caused, and Trump's response to both problems. The coronavirus, he said, is likely to change the landscape of the debate, just as it has for the election. Quote, this time, what's going to be more important than the funny line or the personal attacks is going to be, quote, what's your life like the next day, end quote, when you have to remotely school your child, search for a job if you're unemployed, and God forbid, battle a terrible pandemic, end quote, Barnett said. Aaron Call, debate coach at the University of Michigan, said he expects a lower key set of debates, in part because it would be in Biden's best interest. While Trump would likely want a loud contest, he said Biden would be better off to refuse the bait and draw methodical contrasts on issues like the COVID-19 pandemic and the Supreme Court. Quote, a contentious exchange would be magnified and create its own media cycles, end quote, Call said. The circumstances are also different this election, Call noted. Trump performed poorly in his first debate in 2016 and felt he had to be more aggressive in the second, especially after the revelation of the, quote, Access Hollywood, end quote, tape, in which he was heard speaking about groping women. Amid that furor, Trump packed the gallery with women who claimed improper sexual advances by President Bill Clinton and went on the attack against Hillary Clinton during the debate. The Trump-Biden showdown lacks that kind of melodrama, Everhart said. Quote, the problem or challenge in facing off against Joe Biden is you are talking about someone with a far greater degree of goodwill and higher favorability who in showing empathy has really created an emotional connection with people, and you risk real blowback if you go over the top, end quote, he said. And expected surge in early voting and vote by mail this year over COVID-19 concerns may rise the stakes for the first matchup. The 29 states began mailing absentee ballots to voters in September, and an additional 9 states open up in-person voting this month. Quote, with so many states allowing more than just Election Day voting options, every day becomes a mini Election Day, so the importance of winning along the way and every day and not just cresting and peaking in that final stretch to Election Day is crucial to winning in a way it hasn't been so many states before, end quote, Everhart said. Trump, Barnett said, often goes back to what has worked for him in the past, and in the case of debates, his performance in 2016 primary debates is a familiar balm. Quote, diminishing, dominating, and dissing, end quote, Barnett said. Quote, I think he will revert to that, but I'm not sure that that would be a wise move because I think people are serious right now because they're facing challenges like none of us have ever faced in our lifetime, end quote. If Trump does bring his campaign trail insults onto the debate stage, Barnett's advice for Biden is straightforward. Quote, avoid taking the bait. I think the more the vice president can stay on the substantive issues, the better he'll do, end quote. Our next front page article, how rich Americans avoid high tax bills. Trump isn't alone in using complex legal strategies, by Nathan Bomey. Like President Donald Trump, rich Americans often deploy sophisticated tax avoidance strategies to maximize their wealth. Not to be confused with tax evasion, which is illegal, tax avoidance is entirely legal, even if many view it as unfair. A sweeping New York Times report published Sunday revealed numerous tax reduction strategies used by Trump. He's not alone. Affluent taxpayers often have more avenues than ordinary Americans to avoid paying Uncle Sam. Not all of them use legal strategies. Wealthy Americans are the largest source of underreported income, according to IRS data analyzed by researchers. The top 1% of American taxpayers account for about 34% of misreported income, according to a study published in the National Tax Journal. Other wealthy Americans deploy complex, arcane, but wholly legal methods to minimize their tax obligations. Some use fairly straightforward strategies that allow them to minimize their taxes under the tax code. Here are some of the most common tax avoidance strategies deployed by the wealthy. Growing wealth through investments. It's much harder to avoid taxes on your paycheck than on your investments. In general, the federal government taxes regular wages on higher rates than investment income. The long-term capital gains tax rate maxes out at 20%, and the highest income tax rate is 37%. In other words, if you make a salary of $1 million, the government keeps $370,000. If you make $1 million on stocks or similar investments, the government keeps $200,000. Selling real estate, stocks, and other assets at strategic times. Taxes on assets such as stocks and real estate investments aren't owed until they are sold. That helps people such as Jeff Bezos, the Amazon CEO, founder, and richest person in the world, grow their wealth rapidly while avoiding a huge tax bill. Then they can be strategic about when they sell. By stockpiling assets without selling, rich investors can minimize their tax burden. Quote, wealthy individuals can wait to sell until it makes the most sense for them, such as a year in which they will have large capital losses to offset the gain, end quote, according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Unrealized capital gains accounted for more than one-third of the assets held by the richest 1% of Americans in 2013, according to a Federal Reserve analysis. By comparison, the bottom 90% of Americans have only 6% of their assets in unrealized capital gains. Using business income loopholes. The 2017 tax bill passed, signed into law by Trump, allowed for a 20% deduction on certain businesses' income that passes through partnerships, sole proprietorships, and S corporations. This is income that individuals report on their personal IRS returns, but the tax breaks allow them to reduce the tax rate on that money by up to 7.4 points, according to the CBPP. This setup is most likely to help the wealthy. 61% of the benefits go to the wealthiest 1% of Americans, according to the Joint Committee on Taxation. Lisa De Simone, Associate Professor of Accounting at the McCombs School of Business at the University of Texas Austin, said many tax breaks available for business owners were put into place to stimulate risk-taking and innovation. Quote, there's a notion that there are lots of tips and tricks that only the wealthy can take advantage of, end quote, De Simone said. Quote, the provisions weren't written to try to help the wealthy get away with things, end quote. Instead, she said, new businesses can benefit when they're able to deduct early losses from income. Quote, you don't have to be super rich in order to claim a business loss, end quote, she said, taking advantage of death tax policies. The tax code allows Americans to build wealth through deferred capital gains, then pass those assets tax-free along to their heirs upon death. Called the, quote, stepped-up basis, end quote, tax break, this loophole, quote, encourages wealthy people to turn as much of their income into capital gains as possible and hold on to assets until death, when a lifetime of gain becomes permanently exempt from tax, end quote, according to the CBPP. The inheritor could be subject to paying the estate tax if the total value of the estate exceeds a certain threshold, but the threshold has been substantially increased. The 2017 tax law doubled the amount of a deceased person's wealth that's shielded from the estate tax from about $5.5 million to more than $11 million. The limit is poised to reset to its original amount in 2025 unless Congress takes action. Contributing to this article is Susan Tomper of the Detroit Free Press. And our last front page article, Coronavirus Pandemic, Thousands of Students Disappearing from Rolls, by Aaron Richards. Before life went sideways in March, Jennifer Lutke and her daughters were deeply rooted in the public schools in Las Vegas. Lutke was a principal of a charter high school and had worked in the Clark County School District, and her daughters took advanced classes at a district middle school. This year, after a lot of research about COVID-19 and schooling options, and after the district announced it was starting virtually, Lutke withdrew the girls and enrolled them in a state college that offers online classes. They're earning both college and high school credit in English and math. Because the girls are 12 and 13, the college administrators asked to interview them first, then offered them a grant toward tuition. Lutke resigned from her principal role and stepped back into teaching, which leaves her time to homeschool her daughters in the other necessary subjects such as social studies and physical education. The girls hadn't learned much in the spring when Clark County moved to remote instruction, she said, and the combination of college classes and homeschooling seemed to be the most rigorous option. The upshot, the girls are learning, but they're no longer enrolled in any school district. As parents nationwide tread through a widely different education landscape this year, many kids, like the Lutke sisters, disappear from the rosters of their public schools. Clark County schools are down about 10,000 students this year, a loss that will translate into a reduction of about $61 million from the state of Nevada, though the impact won't be felt right away. It's a similar story in many other large districts that started this year with all children learning virtually. Dallas, Austin, Texas, Los Angeles, Nashville, Tennessee, Miami, and Broward County schools in Florida all reported enrollment declines, missing large swaths of children in the youngest grades. Enrollment equals money for classrooms and teachers, especially in high poverty districts that are funded primarily through state aid. Less money means teachers get moved around, reassigned, or laid off. Or it could mean fewer support services for students or fewer specialized classes or fewer nurses and counselors. In short, less money means less of what students need. It could widen achievement gaps and leave even more children behind. lower-income parents with poor internet connectivity or fewer computers and tablets, or those who can't support their very young children's online learning may opt out altogether. That could make it even harder to catch those children up once in-person daily instruction resumes. Teenagers who have chosen to work rather than return to school virtually, a trend particularly prevalent among low-income Latino families, school leaders said could be a greater risk for dropping out altogether. District leaders said attendance may improve once schools can safely resume full-time in-person learning. Higher income parents have the means to explore other options, such as homeschooling, joining a learning pod with a privately hired teacher, or enrolling in private school. They may stick with those new options even after the pandemic subsides, leaving some schools with less money and a higher concentration of students with the highest needs. Two of the whitest and wealthiest neighborhoods in Clark County, Henderson and Summerlin, saw the biggest drop in enrollment this year, according to district data. In poorer neighborhoods, larger percentages of children showed up to their zoned schools for virtual learning, Ludke said. Quote, we're increasing economic segregation throughout the country, end quote, Ludke said. Quote, your cheapest kids to educate are leaving, end quote. No thanks to virtual learning. About 74% of the country's 100 largest school systems started the year with all remote learning, according to Education Week magazine. Many parents and teachers believed starting virtually was the safest and most efficient option. Others desperately wanted their kids back in school buildings, and many parents of young learners resisted the idea of sitting 4- and 5-year-olds in front of a computer for long stretches, or their work schedules didn't allow them to monitor their young children at home every day. When Las Vegas parent Melissa Ruiz heard Clark County would start the year with remote learning, she called private schools opening with in-person instruction to see if they had space for her 5-year-old son. Ruiz works in a physical therapy office, and she couldn't stay home to monitor her sons. He attends Kids Are Kids Learning Academy every day from 7:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. Ruiz, 29, said the price tag for tuition is steep, $1,000 per month, but her son is learning a lot, she said, and she may keep him in private school if she can afford it. Quote, I don't want him to backtrack, end quote, she said. Some parents don't have the technology to help their children learn from home. In Los Angeles, one of the first school systems this summer to announce it would start the year with remote instruction because of surge of infections, kindergarten enrollment is down about 6,000 students, or 14% from last year, according to the district. In previous years, LA's kindergarten enrollment dropped by about 2,000 students each fall. The biggest declines are generally in neighborhoods with the lowest household incomes, Superintendent Austin Bootner said. Quote, we suspect some of this is because families may lack the ability to provide full-time support at home for online learning, which is necessary for very young learners, end quote, he said at the end of August. In Arizona, Mesa Public Schools, the state's largest school system, started the year online with about 1,000 fewer students than last year, according to district data. In all, 106 out of 145 Arizona districts reported enrollment declines, according to a survey of schools. In Tennessee, Metro Nashville Public Schools enrollment dropped by 4,200 students to 80,842 students this fall. Those losses were concentrated in the youngest grades. Preschool enrollment was down 32%, and kindergarten enrollment was down by 15% from the previous year, according to the district. In Texas, Austin Public Schools enrollment dropped by about 5,000 students to 75,000 students this year, most of the decline in pre-kindergarten and kindergarten. In Dallas, enrollment has been declining by about 1% annually. This year, it dropped by 7% to about 141,000 students, Superintendent Michael Hinojazo said. Schools are missing about 34% of pre-kindergarten students, but only 2% of high school students, he said. Quote, if you lose 7% of your students, that's going to have a big impact on your budget, end quote, Superintendent said, adding that schools schools could lose $30 million to $60 million from the state, high school students missing two. In South Central Los Angeles, Principal Cynthia Gonzalez expected 515 high school students this year, but 503 showed up. Students started dropping off in the spring semester when classes shifted online, she said. Many teens started working full-time to help their families manage the financial uncertainties brought on by the pandemic. Quote, for many of our undocumented families, their citizen children became the breadwinners, and the burden of the survival fell on their shoulders, Gonzalez said. We have several that decided not to return this year because they need to continue to work, end quote. Gonzalez said she also lost students who moved to more affordable states, moved to be with ill family members, or left the country altogether. Students who stayed faced challenges with online learning, most attended virtually, but many do not complete their assignments, Gonzalez said. Many have connectivity issues with their internet hotspots issued to them by the district. A quote, according to my teachers, over half of their students are currently at risk of failing their courses, end quote, Gonzalez said. Because of the enrollment drop, Gonzalez may have to give up a teacher, she said. Several of her principal colleagues are in the same predicament. Quote, many are at risk of losing one or two teachers, Gonzalez said. My biggest fear is that this is happening to some of our most vulnerable communities, which need more, not less, resources to support students, end quote. States such as Texas count average daily attendance as part of enrollment, which means schools can lose money if attendance drops. Not all students log in, especially in high-poverty schools. Hinoza said that in a normal year, Dallas has 95% average daily attendance. This year, after the return to online learning, average daily attendance has fallen to 85%. Quote, that's a double whammy for us financially, end quote, Hinoza said. But Dallas is lucky, he said. The district has more than $600 million in reserves it can use to plug budget holes temporarily. He hopes the legislature will adjust the rules so schools aren't punished financially in the next budget for enrollment and attendance lapses this year. The problem is less acute in wealthier suburbs, where schools generally rely more on property taxes for revenue and less on state aid per student, said Bruce Baker, an education professor at Rutgers University. Without changes to state aid formulas, he said, quote, districts that stand to lose the most from enrollment declines are those that depend the most on state aid, end quote. Private schools welcome students. Families switching to new schools in pursuit of in-person instruction have driven up enrollment in some private schools in smaller districts outside of metro areas. In and around Boston, Catholic schools that reopened for face-to-face instruction gained 4,074 students this year, mostly from public schools that opened remotely, said Thomas W. Carroll, superintendent of schools for the Boston Archdiocese. Quote, when the news hit that Boston Public Schools was going to start virtually, our phones across 100 schools didn't stop ringing, end quote, Carroll said. The Archdiocese schools lost about 5,000 students in the spring when families could not afford tuition amid the financial uncertainties of the pandemic, Carroll said. His team anticipated that drop would continue this fall, but the wave of new students means the Archdiocese can keep open about two dozen schools that were otherwise on a watch list for potential closure. Some small public schools outside metro areas also receive students transferring from urban districts, in particular tourist hotspots where well-heeled families have second homes. Outside New York City, many of the small districts that dot the communities around the North and South Fork of Long Island have seen enrollment boost this year as city families take up full-time residence in their vacation homes. Such moves are less difficult now that parents can work remotely and avoid a long commute to the city. It's too early to know the official enrollment count on this year in New York City public schools. The district delayed the start of the school twice and won't welcome back middle and high school students for some in-person instruction until October 1st. Contributing to this article is Lily Altavina, Arizona Republic, Melissa Tabuda, Austin American Statesman, and Megan Mangrum, the Nashville, Tennessean. Education coverage at the USA Today is made possible in part by a grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which does not provide editorial input. Alrighty, moving over to the opinions page of the Des Moines Register, how a Lou Brock obituary and attack ads are alike Your Turn article by John Edwards. Earlier this month, we lost two baseball greats, Lou Brock and Tom Seaver. Articles about their passing talked about their successes, the times they battled each other on the field, and all that led to their induction into the Baseball Hall of Fame. However, it was a line in the Associated Press story on Brock that caught my attention. Quote, he also made two damaging mistakes that helped cost St. Louis in the 68 World Series, end quote. That line was followed by two paragraphs describing Brock being thrown out at home and being picked off at first base. Brock was one of the greatest hitters in World Series history, helping his team in two World Series titles, and was the best hitter on either side in the Cardinals' World Series loss. Providing his statistics in those games took two sentences, retelling a couple of miscues garnered three times as much space. Of course, those facts were accurate, but I wondered why they needed to be included. They certainly seem to have become standard fare for sports writers describing a player's career. Despite all of the many successes a player may have had, the focus often seems to come back to a mistake that was made, often in a split second. Thankfully, for most of us in our life, we are cut a little more slack. We all make mistakes, some small and some large, but rarely are they recounted at our passing. Most obituaries and eulogies reflect how we hope we will be remembered for the good things we did and not the mistakes we made. And maybe the writer in Brock's case wanted to show that a star made mistakes like the rest of us. Whatever the reason, the mention caught my attention and I wondered why. Perhaps it was due to the current barrage of campaign ads telling us how awful the candidates are. It is hard to imagine how an office holder or a challenger reached the position they are in with the shortcomings or lapses in judgment portrayed in the ads, as we are bombarded with attack ads and follow-up ads saying the attack ads are nothing but lies. It does little to further the process to select the best candidate. When the attacks bear some element of truth, they are rarely representative of a candidate's belief or body of work. And sadly, the attack ads seem to produce successful results, so they aren't likely to go away anytime soon. So where does that leave the prospective voter? It leaves each of us with the responsibility to identify candidates who most closely reflect our values and aspirations, keeping in mind that no candidate will match up perfectly with what we want. How? Finding that information is just a few mouse clicks away. Your county election office should have a sample ballot. Sites like votesmart.org have information on the candidates and their positions on issues, as do the websites of the candidates. So as for your frustration builds as the attack ads increase, resolve to look past those ads and review other information sources. If the attack ads mention one particular act or omission or disconnected needs, ones that is quite different from a pattern of voting or behavior, which should be much more telling. A single error should not be a disqualifier. Lou Brock made mistakes and errors like the rest of us, but as a player and person, he should be judged and remembered for his overall record. Let's accord our political candidates the same difference and judge them by what they say and do, and view attack ads with the critical eye they deserve. Again, this is by John Edwards, who has served in a nonpartisan seat on the Clive City Council for more than 25 years and is a professor at Drake University Law School. The next Your Turn article, Bring My Journalist Brother Home by Thanksgiving, by Jacob Tice. I was at the beach with my family when my brother Austin called. His schedule at Georgetown Law School has prevented him from joining us. I slipped into an empty room at the little house we were renting and listened, astonished, as he told me he was planning a trip to Syria that summer of 2012 and he was taking me to come with him. To this day, I'm not sure why he asked me. We had been on some adventures together to Glacier National Park and in the Pacific Northwest where I have made my home, but nothing approaching these stakes. Maybe he believed that I was up for it, that I had the same adventurous spirit burning in him, and that I would leap at the chance, fresh out of college, with vague plans for the future to help him change the world. I turned him down. I couldn't imagine myself in those circumstances, untrained, lacking the war zone experience he had as a Marine Corps veteran with three tours behind him. I encouraged him to allow his heart to bear witness to the conflict of Syria. I believed in his vision, admired his grit, and I was behind him completely. He left in May. On August 14th, 2012, at a checkpoint outside Damascus, he disappeared. That was 2,974 days ago. I have not heard from my brother since. No one has claimed responsibility for his detention. Every single one of those days and every day, my family wakes up hoping, praying that this will be the last day of his captivity. I think of that call when I read about Austin now and how easily my name could have been next to his. I think of what he has endured in captivity and what he has missed. All the birthdays, weddings, and births, Thanksgivings and Christmases that my family and I have celebrated without him. In dark moments, I wonder whether maybe I could have been the difference. Maybe I would have said, quote, we shouldn't get into this car, end quote. Maybe the hairs on the back of my neck would have stood up at the offer, and maybe we would have gone another way. Maybe he wouldn't have stayed so long had he felt responsible for keeping me, his scrawny and experienced little brother, safe. I don't dwell on those thoughts, but they have persisted. They grew beneath the slow realization that this would not be resolved quickly, beneath the pride of every award he has received and every column calling for his return they possessed. The thought of what he has endured in 8 years is made fresh in each one. I cannot avoid it. I could have been there. No president in our history has been more personally committed than President Donald Trump to bringing home American citizens held abroad. Our president has made it clear time and again, the return of Americans is a deeply personal priority for him. It was for him this March that America first heard Austin's name said aloud by a president. My heart leapt that day. My family appreciates the powerful effort this administration is exerting to bring him home. We have felt the progress centimeter by excruciating centimeter. Now, as we approach a ninth holiday season with an empty seat at our family's Thanksgiving, a ninth Christmas spent wondering whether Austin can see the stars, my brothers and sisters and I implore you from the depths of our hearts, please help. We beg you to reach out to your representatives in Congress. Tell them the story of the brother we love. Tell them it was a priority to see Austin's safest and soonest return. Tell them to use their power to urge the president to restore Austin to our Thanksgiving table. Every second he stays in captivity cuts a deeper wound in the hearts of my family, and we can't wait no longer. Help us make this summer the last he spends alone, and to give 2020 a spark of brightness so we desperately need. Join the campaign. Ask about Austin Tice. Bring him home. Again, this is by Jacob Tice, who is the middle son of seven siblings. You can learn more about Austin at austintycefamily.com. And now for the letters to the editor. Trump Ernst, keep hurting farmers. I grew up on a farm in northwest Iowa. My parents and our neighbors, also farmers, were some of the wisest, most caring people I will ever know. Iowa needs wise, service-oriented leaders and representatives. The denial of some oil refiners' request for exemptions from U.S. biofuel laws helps Iowa, but it's not permanent and did not come until right before the re-election bids by Donald Trump and Senator Joni Ernst. We have cut a deal with China to sell soybeans, but that hinges on the president's relations with China. There could be another potential Cold War between Trump and China. The U.S. can be strong with China without destroying trade relationships. Bullying does not equate with strength. Diplomacy has in the past led to bilateral benefits. Iowans want markets, not just last-minute handouts to garner votes. Iowans, please show your wisdom at the polls and elect leaders committed to wisdom, service, and diplomacy. Joe Biden and Teresa Greenfield. That was by Nancy Willis of Iowa City. Few Trump policies are pro-life. I was raised in the Catholic faith, and I believe in the sanctity of life. However, Kristen Hawkins' September 26th essay, Catholics Can't Ignore Abortion or Harris bigotry strikes me as myopic. She challenges Catholics to, quote, put aside personalities and to focus on, end quote, abortion. I was stunned that Hawkins' support for Donald Trump ignores his apparent brutality toward people he deems unworthy. Immigrants are placed in cages and Black lives don't matter as he sends in troops during protest marches. Restraining the death penalty doesn't show respect for life. Does Trump show he values elderly people as he chips away at Social Security? Attacking the Affordable Care Act and offering no alternative shows little care for people with pre-existing conditions and adequate health care coverage. Trump ignores our climate crisis and works to open pristine forests for longing and fragile landscapes for drilling oil. These acts affect every single person. To me, being pro-life means respecting life from birth to death. I urge voters to remember this consistent lack of compassion for Trump and his supporters. That was by Kay Kopatich of Des Moines. We'll be the judge of that. As an elected official, you can claim to be happy, disappointed, or elated. You can't claim you are, quote, not a crook, not a liar, or not a hypocrite, end quote. Those are labels constituents are left to decide. That was by Marty Ryan of Des Moines. Alrighty, for our political cartoon today, we have Ruth Bader Ginsburg is opening a door, and in that door it says women's rights, and there is a woman who is behind her walking and walking, walking, and once Ruth Bader Ginsburg is gone, the new woman slams the door shut. Okay, moving to the opinion section of the USA Today. How Biden Can Win His First Debate, Be the Only Reasonable Adult on Stage, by Chris Trow. When Donald Trump first exploded on the political scene, he was an unpredictable rule breaker, and neither the news media nor anyone else knew how to handle him. But now we have a much better idea of what makes him tick. First, the Lincoln Project has proved that while President Trump appears formidable, he's really a creature of instinct who's both predictable and unable to defend his weak spots once you find them. Pull the right string and Trump will dance like a cheap marionette and about as gracefully. Second, as we've seen in numerous interviews and a recent disastrous town hall, Trump has a very shallow comfort zone and is quickly out of his depth once he loses control of an interaction. The more you let him talk, especially under pressure, the deeper he will dig his hole. He has even made up what appears to be an entirely new policies on the fly to get out of answering an uncomfortable question. Finally, Trump thrives on anger and conflict. There is no margin in getting into a name-calling match with him. He melts down in the face of pity and laughter, however, and refusing to engage with will infuriate him. Rope-a-dope isn't just for boxing. Sometimes it's an effective debate strategy, too. If Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden puts all these pieces together, he has an excellent chance of reducing President Trump to apoplexy. There he goes again. The first rule is to never rise to the bait and trade insult for insult. Biden's best tactic is to always be the adult in the room. The first time Trump gets nasty, which will probably be in the first 10 minutes because nasty is Trump's go-to move, Biden should look directly into the camera and calmly explain, quote, if insults are what you want from a president, I'm not your candidate. I'm not here to trade insults with President Trump. I'm here to talk about the issues that matter to you, like how we are going to dig out of the coronavirus mess that President Trump has left us in. So let me use my remaining time to talk about that, end quote. When Trump interrupts, as he inevitably will, Biden should resist the natural urge to talk over him. Instead, after Trump has exhausted himself, Biden should shake his head ruefully and say, quote, there he goes again, end quote, and then get back to the point he was trying to make when interrupted. There is the idea out there that forcefully making your point is the key to winning a presidential debate, but that's not the same thing as being unable to control yourself. Biden's campaign is based around him being calm, rational, and a healer. He doesn't win by being more pugnacious than Trump. He wins by being the reasonable adult handling the angry toddler. Finally, trying to fact check President Trump is a losing game. As we saw in his town hall meeting, he can make things up faster than anyone can possibly correct him. But there is a more effective strategy that Biden can employ. He can concern troll the president. When Trump claims, for example, that Biden wants to defend the police, Biden should turn to the camera and say, quote, folks, we have a big problem here. It isn't that Donald Trump lies all the time. It's that he genuinely believes his lies are true. I am on the record multiple times as being against defunding the police. Chris Wallace, our moderator, has pointed that out to him personally on camera, but Donald Trump still believes it. We have someone sitting in the White House who is so confused that he can't tell the truth from fiction. He does this all the time. I'm afraid we're likely to see several other examples of the president's confusion tonight. I am deeply worried about him, and I am deeply worried about this country as long as he is sitting in the Oval Office trying to make decisions, end quote. The Real Reality Show. Trump's greatest, deepest fear is not being taken seriously, so he won't enjoy having attacks dismissed like this. Along the same lines, if Wallace brings up Trump's tax returns, Biden should say, quote, look, I don't blame President Trump for being embarrassed about his tax returns. I would be too if I were him. But here's the deal. This is part of a pattern of Trump playing pretend and refusing to face facts. Despite 6 bankruptcies and a taxable income that would qualify him for food stamps, I think President Trump genuinely believes he's some sort of great businessman. Just like he gives himself an A+ for handling the coronavirus pandemic, even though we've got more than 200,000 people dead, Americans, and rising infection rates. This kind of detachment from reality is killing America, and it has to stop, end quote. There is nothing Joe Biden could possibly say more calculated to rattle the president. Biden isn't actually debating Trump tonight. There are few, if any, people in America who are trying to choose between the Trump agenda and Biden agenda. And certainly no one is going to vote for Biden because he shows he can be just as mean and nasty to Trump as Trump is to him. There are, however, millions of people trying to decide what kind of president Biden would be and whether they are afraid of him. If Biden can destroy Trump without attacking Trump's supporters in the process, this election is all over but the voting. And the best way to do that is to let Donald Trump do it himself. Again, this is by Chris Turow, a member of the USA Today Board of Contributors, is an appellate lawyer in San Diego and CEO of CertifiedVoter.com. And the next opinion, I'll see if I'll be able to finish it. Trump's tax returns should concern voters. They suggest he could be dishonest and a security risk, by Brian Gale. Why do we care about President Donald Trump's tax returns? Is it just because they offer us another episode of reality TV, a window into the lives of the rich and famous? I would argue that there are at least 3 things we learned from his returns that should concern us as voters, not just as voyeurs. First, we learned that it is possible Trump has not been honest with the IRS and maybe even faced potential criminal liability for his dishonesty. Presidents demand sacrifices from citizens and from public servants. Some of us are asked only to pay taxes. Others are faced to death to defend us all. A president who will not even pay his fair share cannot lead. While that is a troubling possibility, it is not certain that Trump paid any less than he owed. It is difficult to judge the honesty of a tax return without examining the surrounding facts. Still, there are red flags that trained IRS investigators know to look for, and several are waiting in the New York Times report on the president's returns. One of them is using a family business money to pay for personal or other family expenses. Trump has run into trouble for doing just that before. A New York court dissolved the Trump Foundation in part because Trump converted its assets to his own use. A family business is not like a foundation in that its assets belong to the family. It's totally legal to take money from a business you own, but when you do, you have to report that money as taxable income. In the case of a partnership such as the Trump Organization, that tax income might not be taxed until a year later, but it still must be reported at the time it is withdrawn. Tax evasion tricks. A common trick is for tax evading business owners to have the business buy things for them directly, then not report the purchase as income for the owner. When I was a federal prosecutor, I saw small businesses pay for their owner's home office renovation, actually a lavish kitchen remodel, or for compensation for love interests of the owner that were actually just big gifts. So when we read that the president claimed deductions for hairstyling, private jets, and big parties at his home, we are seeing expenditures typical of what investigators see in tax evading family businesses. Sometimes they are legitimate. No, you can't deduct your hairstylist expenses, but for many questionable business expenses, an IRS auditor would have to give the taxpayer a chance to prove that. Say, his mansion really is an investment property, not a playground for his adult children. Consider the consulting expenses the Trump Organization reportedly claimed for payments that lined up with payments reported by and entirely controlled by Ivanka Trump. If these were fair payments for services rendered, they'd raise no tax issues. But this is also similar to the other transactions the president's father, Fred Trump, used several decades ago to avoid taxes. The elder Trump, according to the Times, set up shell companies owned by his children and had these placeholder businesses overcharge him for services. In effect, Fred Trump gave gifts to his children without paying income taxes on the value he took from his business or estate taxes on the money he passed to his heirs. Was Trump inspired by his father to set up businesses, overpay them, and then use them to route money tax-free to his kids? To know for sure, we'd need to learn more about what Ivanka's company did and whether experts think it charged a fair price for those services. A broken system. Often this kind of investigation is difficult and expensive, making it challenging for the IRS to discover wrongdoing. Most experts think the IRS is badly understaffed. By some estimates, the IRS collects less than 50% of the taxes owed by the self-employed. So whether Trump underpaid or not, a second lesson his returns teach us is that our tax system is broken. By the admission of the IRS itself, it can no longer afford to audit significant fractions of our wealthiest citizens. When it discovers what it thinks is wrongdoing, it often is outgunned by taxpayers, lawyers, and experts. If his returns don't clearly reveal he did anything wrong, why is President Trump so aggrieved about the revelation? He has reneged repeatedly on promises to reveal his tax returns, fought in court to protect them, even secured the appointment of a business associate of his tax lawyers to be chief counsel of the IRS. We can't be sure what he finds so embarrassing or so damaging. Maybe it's the simple fact that he owes about $400 million to persons or powers unknown. This brings us to our last lesson. When public officials engage in very aggressive tax planning, right or wrong, that planning itself can be a security risk. The president did not want us to know that what was in his returns, and this means those who held bits of that information, his creditors, the folks who worked with Ivanka's consulting company, even his hairdresser, had potentially valuable information. Do we know what they wanted in exchange for keeping it to themselves? It's the kind of compromising situation that usually prevents federal job applicants from obtaining security clearance. As voters, we all have to pass judgment on whether this president should have clearance to govern for another 4 years. Again, this was by Brian Gale, a Georgetown University law professor who spent 3 years as an attorney in the Criminal Appeals and Tax Enforcement Policy section of the Justice Department's Tax Division. For the USA Today political cartoon, we have a man and a woman. The man is sitting at the bar and he has a mask around his neck, and the woman is behind the bar, so she's the bartender, and she has a mask on, and they are watching TV, and the TV says, "Let's get ready to rumble," and the man says, "Wrestling?" question mark, and the woman bartender says, "The Trump-Biden debate." And we just have a little brief article. Global death to toll nears 1 million. In 9 months since the first cases were reported in China, nearly 1 million people have died worldwide from the coronavirus. The milestone comes as countries are at very different stages in managing outbreaks. Some in Europe are tightening up, while some in the United States inch toward reopening despite spikes in new cases in places. Meanwhile, researchers around the globe are making progress on trials for vaccine candidates, though most of us probably won't see doses until at least mid-2021. And then the USA Today has a little blurb about the debates. Join us live to watch the broadcast. USA Today's nationwide team of journalists will display facts and context on the live stream video, and our politics team will be tweeting at USA Today DC when the debate begins at 9 p.m. Eastern Time and will be broadcast for 90 minutes without commercial breaks live from Cleveland. Topics: moderator Chris Wallace of Fox News chose the topics. Candidates' records: the Supreme Court, COVID-19, the economy, racial justice, protests and violence in the U.S. cities, and the integrity of the election. And that is it for our second hour of The Register on Iris. We're so glad to have you listening. I'm your reader, Aaron. Coming up next, obituaries from the Des Moines Register. Thank you.